Thank you very much, Debbie, and thanks to everybody for joining us here today on this gorgeous fall afternoon here in Chicago. So I have to first always have a disclaimer when I talk, that not the typical legal one, but that my professional responsibility is to really suck all the enthusiasm and energy out of these rooms by being the lawyer in the room, and I realize that's just a professional hazard I have, and Drs. Warren and Schlenker will help to raise it much higher than it was when we started, I think, with some great success stories. But part of the reason I say that is because one of the things I'm talking about today, my primary reason to be here, is to talk about the importance of working with lawyers, as distasteful as that may sound, throughout the process of your advocacy efforts. It's really important to involve people who have some expertise in this area at the front end and throughout the process as you're developing policies, so they can help to review policies, help to draft policies, and make sure that you are getting the policy at the end of the day that is what you know is what you want, and it's also going to be legally defensible in the unlikely and hopefully unlikely event that there's litigation that ensues. Oops. As Debbie mentioned, I am an attorney at the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium. We are located in St. Paul, Minnesota. We are a program of the Public Health Law Center. So in my area, I work primarily on tobacco control issues throughout the country. But we also do a lot of work in obesity, healthy eating, active living, so a lot of the other items that we're going to be talking about today as well. And what does that mean when we say we work on legal technical assistance? And I should say it's free legal technical assistance, which is an important aspect of it. That means that we help to draft policies, we help to review policies, we keep abreast of what's going on at the national level with litigation in other states, with policies that have been adopted, so we can help to provide that experience to you and that expertise when you're trying to adopt an initiative for your own jurisdiction. It also means that we help to provide assistance in the event there's a question on an existing policy and the enforcement, or whether a new court case may have some bearing on an existing policy, so we can help with that. Third piece of what we often do is to provide education through seminars, through presentations such as this, as well as we do a lot of publications on some of the fundamental issues in tobacco control and also some of the hot button issues that are coming up that we will talk about more today. And then finally, we do some litigation support, and we can help on primarily in cases that have some national significance, some that may affect other jurisdictions. We can help to prepare local attorneys for the litigation, and we can also, in some cases, provide, they're called amicus briefs, which are friend of the court briefs that are presented to the court on behalf of the public health interest. What we don't do, in spite of what this may look like, it looks like we don't shake hands with people, but that's not entirely true. We don't do any direct client representation, so we don't have any clients of our own, which means that we don't do the litigation ourselves. And we also don't do any lobbying, which makes it kind of an unusual experience to be talking to this group today. But we do work very closely with advocates, with state and local health departments, officials at all levels of government. And then we also work very closely with both governmental and non-governmental attorneys in crafting policies. Often attorneys get sort of categorized in one of those two, either the dolt that you don't want to be around, or the devil. And our goal here is to really try to provide you a third alternative, and hopefully we feel like public health lawyers would fit into that. And today I'm going to talk about some of the assistance that organizations like ours that we can provide to you, and I'm going to talk about it specifically through the lens of electronic cigarettes. But a lot of the things that I will touch on have significance beyond e-cigarettes and can be used. You know, the fundamental principles tend to be the same. We always say that at the end of the day, what you want to do, you want to make sure that you understand your own policy goals, what you want to accomplish. And once you have that part, we can help you move the process along, tell you whether that's feasible or not, and tell you how you can get there. By helping you understand what the legal framework is, both within your jurisdiction and whether there's anything external, any federal laws that might have some bearing on what you want to do. We encourage the use, in spite of what you may believe, that lawyers don't believe this, but clear, concise, simple language is always preferable. Anything that gets extraneous, gets too cute, is always up for interpretation by a judge, and you prefer not to have that. And then finally, going into anything with your eyes wide open, making sure that you understand, even in the best case scenario, there's always a possibility that there's going to be litigation. Your goal is to avoid that if possible, but to make sure, if it happens, that you will win. So what's a name? We started looking at e-cigarettes a few years ago, like probably everybody did, and we come out and we give these talks about e-cigarettes, and they're, you know, these are the bottom left-hand corner for the most part. It's kind of these products that look like cigarettes, and I feel like we were kind of educating people at one point, and now I come out and I feel like I'm learning from everybody in the field who's saying, oh no, these, you know, you haven't seen these things yet, and there's the products are morphing so quickly. It's really difficult to keep a handle on what they are. For today's purposes, I'll use the term e-cigarettes, and when I use that term, I'm kind of referring to the whole universe of products, including the e-juice as well. So when we started this process, we were kind of in the wake. In 2009, the FDA tried to regulate e-cigarettes as drug delivery devices, and the court said that they didn't have the authority to do that. So we knew that they had the authority under the Tobacco Control Act to regulate e-cigarettes as tobacco products. And so a lot of jurisdictions would say to us, well, why don't we just wait and see what the FDA does, and then we can kind of supplement that or see maybe that will take care of what, you know, what our needs are. And we said, well, you know, probably not the best idea for a couple of reasons. One is because the FDA only has authority to regulate tobacco products. So only the products that are made or derived from tobacco. That means, for example, e-cigarettes that purportedly don't contain nicotine, although we know that when tested, many of those that say they don't have nicotine do. Those, the FDA has no authority to regulate, so those would be outside of all regulation. And two, there are certain category areas that the FDA doesn't have the authority to regulate as well. We know that for tobacco usage, that price has a huge bearing on usage, especially for youth initiation. Kids are very, very price-sensitive consumers. So if the price goes up, kids are less likely to be introduced to tobacco products. The FDA does not have taxing authority, so that's something that has to be done at the state and local level. And it's one of the most effective policies. Smoke-free is another one. The FDA doesn't have authority to regulate where these products can be used. So that's something that has to be done at the state and local levels. And that's actually an issue that's become a lot more significant, especially in states that have legalized marijuana. Recreational marijuana, because the devices, the vaporizers or aerosolizers, are being used to ingest marijuana surreptitiously in a lot of these locations. So it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's crossing over now that we're seeing that makes it even more important that state and local governments do take take proactive steps to regulate these products. All regulation starts with good definitions. And this has been far more difficult than I could ever imagine. It's almost embarrassing to tell you how much time we spend internally on defining e-cigarettes. It's something that we have, at least once a month, I feel like we get together as a team and work through what we've seen new in the market, what that means for our definitions, how that should be changed. There was a great study that was in Tobacco Control magazine last December by Stan Glantz and his colleagues at UC San Francisco, just going looking at state by state all the definitions that different states are using. We have a very similar analysis on our own website. But suffice to say that a lot of states are defining them in different ways. A lot of them are defining them in the way the tobacco industry wants them to be defined, in a very narrow way, which means that a lot of the products are falling outside of the regulation. So we have sample definitions on our website, or that we, you know, can work with you to develop for your own jurisdiction that can help to be develop a really broad definition that will encompass lots of hopefully the universe of products. And our suggestion is to include those within the tobacco products definition, so the regulation takes effect for all these products simultaneously and doesn't have to be done piecemeal. So what we also see a lot when we are talking to jurisdictions about developing policies, that they have a model policy and they would like to use that. It's a great idea. Model policies can be wonderful. There are some great ones out there. But one thing that's important, and one of the reasons why we like to work with everybody individually, is that every jurisdiction has its own idiosyncrasies in its law. There's always something that's kind of unique. Tax codes are different, definitely different in all states, but even youth access codes are different. There's different preemption issues which I'll talk about a little bit later at the state level. So it's important that if you use a model policy, we tend to call them samples because we don't like to, you know, have it seem like something can be plopped into an existing law. It's important to work with somebody who can see how it fits with, you know, more holistically within your statutory or your city code sections. So getting into the actual policies, this is one area where I'll talk about one specific policy area and why, you know, how approaching the same policy goal two different ways can result in drastically different outcomes. And this is, again, going back to the pricing policy. We know that tax is often just not on the table in a lot of jurisdictions. You know, taxation is a four-letter word. So there are other options to regulate price and to make sure that pricing of these products remains at a high level. And one of those is restricting coupons. So the kids can't get a e-cigarette for $1. They can't get a pack of cigarettes for $1. Some jurisdictions have had great success in using these. One notably is Providence, Rhode Island, which restricts the redemption of coupons. These have been litigated in a couple jurisdictions, and the regulations have been upheld. But what's important to know, and this is, again, why it's good to talk to somebody early on, is depending on how that regulation is structured, makes all the difference in whether it's going to be upheld. If it's a regulation that says you can't redeem a coupon, so it focuses on the sale of the product, that's absolutely fine, that's upheld, you can do that. If you say you can't distribute coupons to any potential customers, that will almost inevitably be struck down as an impermissible violation of the First Amendment, so these commercial speech requirements. And the courts have been getting much stronger in their protection of commercial speech over the last few years. So it's important whenever possible to learn how to frame the policy goal and the policy itself so that it focuses on the actual sale and not the marketing advertising component of it. Exemptions, another area where we sit in our offices all day and we fully understand that we can come up with great policies, we can come up with great, you know, options, and they're foolproof and they're tight and there's no exemptions for anybody, and that you're working in the real world where that's not always possible. But it's always important to remember that exemptions not only are bad for public health, but they can actually, in some cases, make it much more susceptible to a legal challenge if you have an exemption. And we saw this a lot in smoke-free laws, where you would have an exemption for a cigar bar or a certain type of a pharmacy, for example, in San Francisco. And those who are not exempt will say, well, you know, why are we treated differently? There should be, you know, there's an equal protection issue here. We should be treated the same way as those. In many cases, the courts will say, you know, you're right, and the whole law can be struck down because of an exemption. So exemptions, although I know sometimes that, you know, that the political reality is that they become a part of the law, it's important to also remember that beyond public health, there's a strong reason to keep them in the law. Not to mention they, you know, can be make it difficult to enforce. You know, if you have exemptions based on the percentage of sales that are in certain types of products or things like that, some of those are just hard to enforce, especially for local governments. I heard about this case. We get this a lot. So-and-so's brother, his cousin's dad is a lawyer somewhere, and he's, you know, and he heard about this case, and he's pretty sure that it means that we can't do X, Y, and Z in our jurisdiction because the courts have said they just don't think it's, you know, it's going to fly. And it's hard to track that down sometimes. It's, you know, it's confusing. It's confusing to know which courts have precedent for your own jurisdiction because the court system it can be kind of complicated. So we do track all that stuff very closely. We can help to understand it. One recent example that we heard multiple times was a certain community that had a Tobacco 21 law, and they ended up pulling back on it under the threat of litigation. So we had other jurisdictions saying, is that something that we shouldn't be doing? Is that, you know, is Tobacco 21 something that, for some reason courts have said that you can't do? And the answer is no. In this case, it was a threat of litigation based on a very specific issue in that jurisdiction that wouldn't have any relevance in other states. So again, those are kind of things you can talk to, you can call our offices, and we can give you hopefully a pretty quick answer on this is something to be concerned about or this is something you shouldn't. On the other hand, and this is the area where it gets, I think, even a little more complicated, is sometimes there are court cases that have nothing to do with the topic area that you're looking at. Specifically, this happens a lot in First Amendment cases, where you'll have something that's litigated. There was a recent case in Arizona that related to the placement of signs for a particular church service. And the ruling in that, I won't go far into it except to say that it was a very broad ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court level, which means that it has precedence on every court. And it could really potentially have some significant effects on marketing restrictions and advertising restrictions, signage requirements in a lot of jurisdictions around the country. So again, it can go both ways, but it's important to kind of talk to somebody who keeps their keeps abreast of what's going on. How many of you work in tobacco control? If I could just ask, does anybody do? Okay, great. So not many. This is a non-tobacco audience for the most part. How many people know what preemption is? Is that something you deal with much in your communities? Okay, a smattering. Well, preemption is it's a tactic that's been used very effectively in the tobacco control world for many years. And preemption basically it's a very simple concept. It means that a higher level of government, so for example, the federal government has the authority to say a lower level doesn't have, it can restrict their authority to regulate in certain areas. State can do the same to a local government. So it's basically how much power flows from the federal government to the state government to the local government. And if you kind of put something, language in there, legislation at a higher level, it can have really dramatic effects downstream. And the problem is preemption provisions are often added at the very end, right when what would be seemingly a good policy is about to be adopted, and they're often posed with language that isn't particularly clear. Probably intentionally, because that can have a very chilling effect. Nobody really wants to be litigated, and so if you don't know if there's preemption or not, it can be really problematic. This is an example from Philip Morris of one of their internal documents that's been uncovered at one of the discovery on the Philip Morris case. While we're not married to any particular form of preemption language, we're dead serious about achieving preemption in all 50 states. This is a very serious thing because this can, it can inhibit tobacco control or any public health policy throughout the state and local governments. So this is an example of a preemption provision. So it says, no county resolution or city ordinance that prohibits smoking in indoor areas shall apply to cigar bars. And this one I think is, it's fairly straightforward. It says local governments, it's in a clean indoor air act, this was in Nebraska, and it said they don't have the authority to make cigar bars smoke free, which seems like a crazy concept, but that was the way the law was written. This was ended up, the exemption itself was struck down, so this didn't apply ultimately, but that's what I would call a fairly clean preemption language. This is one that we saw just last year. So this was a youth access law for e-cigarettes in Missouri, and as you probably know, most states, because there's no federal regulation of e-cigarettes at this point, anybody could buy them. No, there's no age restrictions at all. So most states implemented laws and said, minors can't buy e-cigarettes, which seems like it was a pretty reasonable, and it was pretty hard for anybody, tobacco industries included, to argue that that wasn't good policy. But so this was an example in Missouri where they said, okay, that sounds like that's fine. We're going to go along with that. And at the very end, we get this other language that says, but, okay, they shall be subject to local and state sales tax. Okay, that makes sense. But they shall not otherwise be taxed or regulated as tobacco products. That's kind of strange, isn't it? So your youth access law now says that the state itself doesn't have the authority to tax these products, which doesn't make any sense. If the state decides that it's going to tax them and puts it in tax code, certainly that would override, but it would probably be litigated at some point because you'd have some inconsistency within the law. But what's even more concerning is that last clause, which says they should not otherwise be regulated as tobacco products. That could be really broad. Who knows what that means? Does that mean that you can't regulate e-cigarettes, you can't define them as tobacco products and regulate them as such? Or does that mean that you can't regulate them in the same way that you would regulate tobacco products? I have no idea. But it's the kind of language that you really want to avoid whenever possible, because it's going to lead to litigation. It's going to have a chilling effect on local governments who are willing to take to introduce something at the risk of it being litigated. So being on the lookout for some of the key words. And these are some of the things that we've seen in lots of laws. Supersede, shall be consistent with, uniform state standard, exclusive, occupy the field. I mean, all these are kind of buzzwords that create preemption and create it in sort of an ambiguous way so we don't know what that necessarily means. So when you see those kind of words, and especially when you see them come at the very at the 11th hour in a bill, it's important to start really rethink this what's happening there. We strongly suggest including very strong anti-preemption language in any of these provisions, and that's something like what we have in this first one, which says nothing in the statute shall be construed to limit a local jurisdiction from regulating electronic cigarettes. Very broad, cuts against any argument that there's been this field occupation, meaning that there's no regulation of this product. What we often see, though, even with that, is we'll see that that'll get winnowed down to something else, which can have negative effects, where it says, okay, how about this? We'll give you the broad preemption language. We're gonna narrow it so that it's for the sale of flavored electronic cigarettes. Again, does that mean that anything beyond that is then preempted? I don't know. And ambiguity. It's always a bad thing from our perspective, from public health perspective. You want things to be very, very clear what the intent is. And then finally, any of these laws, we encourage including a severability clause. The severability clause just basically says that if any part of this law is struck down, the rest of the law will remain. That's an important component because we see litigation a lot, and you don't want one bad apple, one bad provision to strike down an entire law. So again, just to wrap things up, we try to help to provide a roadmap, and the best way for us to do that is if you can talk to us early on in the process, tell us what your goals are, what you're hoping to accomplish, and we're happy to try to kind of walk you through. It's not always an easy process to get from point A to hopefully your final destination. I encourage you to check out our resources online, to contact us. I'm around. Jay, our communications director, is here as well. You can talk to us at any point, but feel free to give us a call anytime. We're happy to talk to you. We work, again, we are free, and we work all around the country. So thanks so much for being here.